You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, and joining you on November the 8th, otherwise known as International Cappuccino Day, the contentious coffee-based beverage, which, as we learned from our friend Alberto Grandi of the University of Parma earlier this year, may owe its popularity to clueless German tourists on the Adriatic Riviera in the 1950s and 1960s, even if its name is reported to derive from Marco Daviano, a Capuchin monk who demanded a dollop of steamed milk to take the edge off his extra shot venti americano in a Viennese coffee house in September 1683. That may be true, that story. I may have added a little flourish there for my own entertainment. My name is Daniel Freiber. I am the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will, as ever, endeavour to blow the froth off the big talking points in the world of pro cycling. And also today, in light of last week's discussion of a new plan to shake up pro cycling, explain why the coffee resembling previous attempts to do the same has been not a cappuccino, but an affogato. That is the sunken one. My fellow barista today is a man who has been personally involved in one of those efforts to reheat the cold brew that is the pro cycling business model. It is Il Barone, the great Dane Brian Nygaard. How are you, Brian? We haven't had you on for a while. We've missed you.
Well, seeing you, and I'll just have to explain to my our listeners what you're wearing right now, and it might be the off season for the riders, but you look like some like a crazy French fan that's been merged with a mountaineering person who got lost in the Tibetan, you know, altitude.
Well, that's actually not too far from the truth, Brian, because this was supposed to be a holiday week for me, and I'm in a mountain hideaway in the Dolomites.
I can tell that you're not in the Beverly Hills Hotel, Daniel.
No, very much in my element up here in the Val d'Ultimo, which is a very remote valley. I'm actually not in the Dolomites. I'm in Südtirol, Alto Adige, the German-speaking part of Italy. It's not a very well-known valley, the Val d'Ultimo, Ultental in German. It's sort of the backside of the Stelvio. If you get to the end of the valley, you go into the Stelvio National Park, and the Giro d'Italia almost never visits the
Val d'Ultimo. All of this sounds like this must be a spiritual home. It really ticks all the Daniel Freiber boxes.
It very much is. It very much is. And I'm drinking a glass of Forst, which is the local beer, an excellent Tyrolese beer which everyone drinks up here, brewed in Merano. Yesterday I had lunch in the Force Brewery in Merano, so yeah, having a splendid time, Brian. And well, we thought the listeners, as I said, we're supposed to be on holiday this week, but we thought the listeners deserved a podcast every week, hence here we you are, Brian. What have you been up to the last couple of weeks?
Well, you know, after the cycling season's ended, because I don't think you and we've caught up occasionally, but that's just sending trashy memes yes, to each other, which has nothing to do with with the cycling podcast. Yeah, so I went to California and made wine for a month's time, produced a little bit more than I expected, which is always great. And I just got back from Copenhagen, Denmark. I'm doing a book with a Danish chef, and actually it's actually four books, but it's a big one and three small ones, and I just got back from the first session of that. And then actually, I don't know if I'm supposed to say this, but I am anyways, and tomorrow I'm off to Amsterdam to participate in a Amazon Prime second season of a Dutch show about Jumbo-Visma.
Ah, so you've obviously not signed a non-disclosure agreement.
And you suggest those usually end up in my spam mail.
Well, Brian, that all sounds very interesting. The cookbooks, what is it, sort of, you know, 50 best lasagna recipes, that kind of thing?
Pretty much.
Yeah. And Brian, news roundup time on, as I said, International Cappuccino Day. Cappuccino Day in itself is a bit of a misnomer, because it should only really be Cappuccino Morning, shouldn't it? International Cappuccino Day should end at about 11 o'clock in the morning.
It can never be
anyway,
full day.
It is. No. Anyway, it is International Cappuccino Day, and this is the week that was in professional cycling. There was worrying news for cycling in Britain this week, Brian, with reports that the National Federation British Cycling has prematurely ended the agreement whereby the Sweet Spot Group organises and promotes the National Tour, aka the Tour of Britain. Sweet Spot has run the race since 2004 and was contracted to do so at least until 2029. The dispute, or schism, has reportedly come about because Sweet Spot owe British Cycling money, reports say around £700,000. Lawyers are currently dealing with the dispute, but Sweet Spot have also said they're confident that they may yet organise the Tour of Britain in 2024 and also the Women's Tour, another one of their races. This also comes against the backdrop of tough squeeze times for pro cycling in the UK, with the Tour of Britain having already gone ahead without a title sponsor this year. In addition, last week, Cycling Weekly reported that British Cycling's latest set of accounts showed a £1.3 million annual loss. Brian, as an outsider, is all of this quite baffling to you, given the, you know, the giddy days, the glory days, the golden era that we all lived through and all experienced? You know, you were in that era briefly.
I was on that payroll,
Team Sky. Yes, you were on that Team Sky. You were on the gravy train, Brian.
Yeah.
What do you make of it all?
I mean, there's a lot of moving parts in it, and I don't know the elements of whether someone has done a poor job at spending the money and or making investments, but as we'll talk about later on in this podcast, there's also some external factors right now in the global economy and in the economy of sports that are certainly not beneficial to cycling. My feeling has always been that the Tour of Britain has been very sort of well followed by fans and attracted quite good international peloton, but it's never really, to me, come across as a race that had a lot of attention from the outside in. And I'm not sure if that's affected their ability to get funding and get sponsorship.
Yeah, I mean, we will endeavour in the next few weeks at least to have Mick Bennett, good friend of the podcast, one of the chiefs of the Tour of Britain. We'll have him on to sort of explain the or give a Sweet Spot side of the story, maybe, if he's willing to do so. But as you say, there's sort of, I get the impression sometimes, just more widely outside of Britain, there's a sports sponsorship fatigue. Regardless of what other squeezes, what other economical issues, financial issues that businesses are facing, it almost feels as though the kind of golden age of sponsorship and this idea that sponsorship was kind of a silver bullet for a company's fortunes, they may be gone. And as you said, we will talk a lot about that later on.
Not just UK-based businesses, but a lot of cycling businesses in general are not doing that well. You know, I wouldn't say we've been in a bubble, but you see a lot of business that produce parts for bikes, you know, selling bikes, selling all kinds of things bike related, are not doing as great as they did just a couple of years ago. And now that we're probably past the supply chain issues that COVID put upon the industry, it's as if now that it's sort of consolidating again to like a normal way of running their business, it's as if the business is not really back to normal at all. So that's obviously worrying, but it's probably also a little bit more realistic that the craze about bikes and buying bikes and buying expensive bikes has died down a little bit, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And we're definitely not beyond the sort of overstocking, overgrowing, overexpanding age, which sort of came about as a result of COVID and which saw the bike industry experience a massive boom, if it was pretty short-lived. Brian, as I said, more about the business of professional cycling later in the episode. A couple of bits of transfer and contract news. The Aussie national road race champion Luke Plapp has left Ineos Grenadiers a year before his contract with them was due to expire. He's gone home, as it were, to Jayco Alula, penning a four-year deal. Luke Plapp was a rider who, when he turned professional a couple of years ago, was the subject of a lot of hype, He lived up to it to a certain extent. Certainly has done at certain times in certain races. For example, I mentioned there the Aussie National Road Race Championship. But this year, he certainly really struggled. But four-year deal, that's a measure of how much Jake Olula believe in him. Great character, very entertaining character. Certainly a very interesting, engaging interviewee. Brian, I don't think it's rude to say that the 37-year-old Ben Hermans is at the other end of his career arc. And Hermans is one of two riders Cofidis have signed this week to beef up their climbing division. Hermans signing from Israel Premier Tech. And with him, wait for it, King Kenny Elizonde arriving from Little Trek. I was delighted to hear that King Kenny is continuing his career as a professional cyclist, Brian, because I've alluded to this over the last few weeks, but Kenny and I had a few conversations at the Vuelta a España, and much in the same way that our very good friend, the Motown maestro Larry Warbass, was a sort of a beaten down figure at the end of the Vuelta a España, Kenny was sort of similarly downbeat because he'd had a tough race. The race was incredibly fast, and he and I had numerous conversations about how the life of a pro cyclist is getting harder and harder, and there are more and more sacrifices involved. And Kenny is someone who has a broad range of interests, and he likes to pursue them. Nothing, you know, no great vices there, but, you know, he likes to go to the cinema. He likes to maybe have one glass of wine of a November evening around a log fire. And there is a sort of sense among those older riders that, well, A, the youngsters don't do that, and B, they, as older riders, can't afford to do that stuff anymore. I'm not financially.
To go to the cinema?
Go to the cinema, have a glass of, you know, Rioja of a Thursday night. Oh, I don't know, Brian.
Then we definitely should. Then we should all be concerned. I thought I made way less money than any of those guys.
We've got big problems. Last bit of contract news. Brian, Astana have confirmed that Mark Renshaw will remain with the team in 2024 as a DS. Renshaw again linking up with Mark Cavendish, with whom he, of course, enjoyed huge success when he, that is Renshaw, was a rider. Brian, Renshaw got rave reviews at the Tour de France this year from pretty much everyone at Astana. I think he brought a level of detail to proceedings that had been lacking at that team, was lacking for much of the year. They didn't have a particularly successful year. And Renshaw, I think, he'll be an asset. Definitely. Brian, doping news. We recorded last week, just a little bit late, to include reports that Jumbo-Visma's 22-year-old German rider Michael Hessmann had his anti-doping violation, he tested positive in June, upheld after the analysis of his B sample by the German National Anti-Doping Agency. Hessmann's urine contained traces of a banned diuretic, can be used as a masking agent. He now faces a four-year ban or 2 years if he can prove that substance entered his body due to contamination. Jumbo-Visma boss Richard Plugger had previously said that his team must look themselves in the mirror to assess, well, what's gone wrong here, which I don't think he's suggesting that, well, I know he's not suggesting that the team had any role in Hessmann taking a banned substance, but there was a lot of talk about this kind of oversight of riders by teams, in the era we referred to a minute ago, Brian, when you were at Sky, for example, when a lot of riders were still testing positive, we almost got tired of the press releases in which a team would say, you know, our team has nothing to do with, or we take no responsibility for rider X testing positive. But yeah, this doping news in general, we've not had a lot of it over the last couple of years.
No, we certainly haven't. And isn't that jolly, you know, in the sense that it's even to the point now without knowing all of the details. I feel like I'm writing a press release now, but without knowing all the details in the current case with Hessmann, that not automatically, but there's a bigger part of me now that thinks that what went wrong, in the sense that what kind of mistake did he make to have that substance in his sample, you know, more than, you know, masking agents sounds peculiarly old school, you know, because the whatever you're masking will show up anyways in a, you know, in an anti-doping test, most likely anyways, because they're so finely, you know, when you look at the trace amount that needs to be there for it to be positive, it's so minuscule that you kind of feel like it's almost a surprise that someone would get caught with something like that. But yeah, as a reflection of how things have changed, you know, I'm not shrugging my shoulders at someone jeopardizing the team and ending his career. But I just think the context now is a little bit different when it happens.
I think we haven't heard too much from Hessman, if anything, actually. I suspect that he will try to argue that it is contamination. And, well, the issue there is that it becomes very expensive for these riders to mount legal cases, particularly if they're left high and dry by their team. In this case, Jumbo-Visma had backed Hessman up until now. Whether they will continue to back him, whether they will do so publicly, we're not sure. But for a rider, a 22-year-old rider on his own, to go out and recruit lawyers who will work over a period of weeks and months to prove that this was an unwitting mistake, is very, very expensive and pretty difficult. Brian, finally, my favourite bit of the pod, cyclocross news. We've had European Cyclocross Championships in Pontchâteau in France this week, with Femke van Empel taking an emphatic win in the women's race, and Michael van Hoorenhout also defending his title in the men's race. In that one, Great Britain's Cameron Mason was a very impressive second. At the weekend, the World Cup resumes with the races in Dendermonde. I know enough about cyclocross and Belgium to tell you that that is in Belgium.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by LinkedIn Jobs. Now, if you run a small business and you're looking to hire somebody for your company, it can feel pretty high stakes because you don't have the luxury of making the wrong decision. Hiring somebody for any company, small, medium or large, is a big deal. But when you run a small business, you want to be 100% certain that you have access to the best qualified candidates available. And that is really where LinkedIn Jobs comes into its own, because LinkedIn can help you find the right people for your team quickly and for free. In fact, 4 out of 5 jobs advertised on LinkedIn attract a qualified candidate within 24 hours. And that is because LinkedIn has a huge network of professional people. More than 770 million people are on LinkedIn, and the right person for your organization will undoubtedly be out there somewhere. And LinkedIn Jobs, with the ability to post a job ad for free, gives you the best chance of attracting those candidates. So it's very simple to do. You write your job description, make it very clear the role and responsibilities and the type of person that you're looking for. And then you add the job ad and the purple hashtag hiring frame to your own LinkedIn profile. And that will help to spread the word that you're on the lookout for somebody. Then there are a series of simple tools such as screening questions, which make it easy to narrow down that search and focus on the candidates with just the right skills and experience for your company. And then you can quickly prioritize who you'd like to interview and ultimately hire. And that is why small businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs as the number one when delivering quality candidates against some of the other competitors. If you'd like to give LinkedIn Jobs a try, you can post a job ad for free at linkedin.com/cycle. That's linkedin.com/cycle. Post your job ad for free and then wait for the right person to apply.
Well, Brian, I hinted in the intro, in the first part to today's episode, that you'd been hand-selected, you'd been hand-picked like a perfectly ripe, I don't know, Pinot Noir grape for this podcast this week, because we wanted to talk a little bit more about an issue that we touched on with Larry. It was Larry Warbass and me last week, the Motown Maestro. We touched on this recently broken story about a group of teams, 6 teams, working together in something they were calling one cycling harmony group or harmony project, with a view to creating some sort of new league in professional cycling, with a view, probably, we imagine, they don't really need to spell this out, to earn a bit more money and to make cycling's professional cycling's business model a little bit more sustainable. Of course, we know it's not sustainable at all, as evidenced by the fact that the world's number one team, Jumbo-Visma, recently, well, seemed, maybe they were not, but seemed to be in difficulty. Some would even say on the precipice. So, Brian, we briefly prefaced, I think, what will be a longer discussion last week. But since we do have you here, let me just ask you, Brian, when you saw these stories, heard these stories, as someone who has a bit of experience in these matters, as we'll go on to discuss in a minute, what did you think?
Well, first of all, I'm not surprised. You know, even if you take away the context of cycling being cycling and everyone repeatedly say that the business model is not sustainable, there are elements in this new story or new group that's different in a way that it involves an entity that has a proven record in wanting to invest an immense amount of money in sports. If there's a connection to, say, Saudi Arabia, we've seen that in other sports, and there's a tendency for those investments to be very, very huge. You know, a lot of dollar figures, a massive amount of money that they can potentially throw at something like that. So that's I think that's the new element. But that cycling teams want to try and create a business model that doesn't put potentially the best teams in the world. You know, are hanging by their fingernails at the edge of the cliff, even if they've done everything right. I think that's normal for any, you know, anyone, you know, regardless of what they do, because there's a discrepancy between your sporting success and between the visibility that you create, and then at the same time not being able to secure your budget. So because of that, it's normal that anyone in that position will try and seek out other possibilities. And cycling, it happens quite often. A little bit more than a decade ago, the last really serious effort, but now it's come back in the context of how sport and massive Middle Eastern funding can actually change things quite dramatically and quite fast.
Brian, a point I didn't make, a challenge I didn't put to Larry last week, but just to play devil's advocate, and again, before we go into some of the historical context of all of this, when we talk about sustainability, one could argue that the agencies, the individuals in this whole discussion who have ensured that professional cycling is not sustainable are the teams themselves, because they have escalated salaries, whether it's the riders and their agents have escalated salaries, but the teams have buckled and they've paid those salaries. More than anyone, well, they are the culprits for this situation. Nowhere is it written in the UCI constitution that the best rider in the world needs to earn 6 million euros a year or 7 million euros a year. And as I say, I called it an escalation, and it has been quite a fast escalation. We talked in the podcast back when it happened about, I think it was the contract that Peter Sagan signed with Tinkoff, which took him way over 3 million, I think towards 5 million euros. And that seemed like a bit of a watershed. That seemed like a bit of a quantum leap. And there have been a few more of them since. And when we talk about the lack of sustainability and the costs involved in running a professional cycling, effectively, we're talking about the wage bill. That's the problem.
But I think that needs to be qualified a little bit because of the current situation. Even if you go back 10 years, it needs to be qualified a little bit. There's no salary cap, which means there's no finite amount in professional cycling. And two elements are relevant in that. Now there are let's say there's a small handful of teams whose budget is a lot bigger than the rest of the group, which now consists of the World Tour consists of, and they will compete for the same type of riders, and they can only compete via spending money. I would like to isolate that from how some certain bike manufacturers are willing to invest in certain riders, not just because of their result, but because of their personalities. And that, I think that's a little bit two separate things. However, in the last decade, starting, I would say, probably with Trek going into being a team owner, the element of the bike industry as an investor, as a considerable amount of investment in cycling coming from bike manufacturers, it also changes a little bit how the cult of personality around some riders will make them a lot more expensive. So yeah, there will never be a finite amount of money in a sport where there aren't any franchises, there aren't any stadiums, and there aren't any salary caps. And lastly, but very importantly, there's not a redistribution of money that comes from selling TV rights. So that's one of the reasons. But it's, some of it is contingent of the current financial situation, but I think all of it is, it can be rationally calculated to predictable behavior.
Brian, let's press pause there and let's step into our time machines, our respective time machines, and let's journey back, Brian, to a time where you were younger, you were more romantic about the world. You had a budding career in professional cycling as you were still a press officer back then. In around 2004, 2005, that's the time I'm talking about. And this is a key point in the discussion we are currently having about business models and potential fractures between UCI, ASO, teams and so on and so forth. Brian, what happened in 2004, 2005? Because I think you were sort of at the bleeding edge of some of this.
Yeah, I mean, just to take you immediately into how it felt, you know, that I think it was my second or third season in pro cycling, and I came into the sport thinking that it was a very solid entity, and everyone knew what everyone wanted. And, you know, once you've done your first Tour de France and any other Grand Tour that's not the Tour de France, you realize very quickly that ASO has a way of operating, has a way of controlling things in the sport that doesn't have any, it doesn't have any equal in cycling. And I realized that quite early, that they are the most powerful organization. They're more powerful than the teams all put together. They're more powerful than the UCI and the teams put together. And in those exact years, when the UCI were quite interested in taking charge of what they felt like they owned, and they own two things in cycling, really, apart from the rights to sell TV for the World Championships, is they own the regulation and they own the calendar. And they wanted to solidify that by creating the Pro Tour, which is now, you know, in other iterations, it's called the World Tour. But they created the Pro Tour, and it actually became such a conflict, it escalated very fast. And the evening before Paris-Nice in March, we didn't actually know whether we were going to race or not, because the ASO...
You were the CSC press officer at the time.
Yeah. I think you actually ended up winning that race. But we didn't know if the race was to be held, because the ASO refused to be part of the Pro Tour. And the reason why they refused that should also be seen in the context of that era, was because that meant they didn't decide who could ride the Tour de France, which was really, you know, the big ticket race. And they didn't want anyone else to decide that, because they've had their struggles, and later on they would have even more struggles with teams they didn't want at the race. So they wanted full control of who was riding the ASO races. So that's why it was a difficult birth for the Pro Tour. And to finish off, it highlighted the power struggle that could, in my opinion, maybe not in the same way today, but could always only be won by the ASO, because they own the only thing that can really make a cycling team make money or have that type of exposure that would attract a big sponsor.
Brian, they wanted to decide who rode their races, but is it also true to say, and this is a point that a lot of people make, including last week I referred to a long conversation I'd had with someone who has been involved in attempts to, let's say, diversify and strengthen, bolster the pro cycling financial model. He said that ASO want to divide and conquer, that they want to keep the teams weak and make sure that nothing matters except the tour. So would you agree with that? That it was more complicated then, and it would be more complicated now, than just deciding that this team rides Paris-Nice, this team rides the Tour de France, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, there's an underlying agenda, of course. I think for several reasons, one of them being that if they felt that the teams, either with the UCI or without the UCI, it became too coherent an entity, that they would become a threat, right? That's why you want to divide and conquer. And also imagine, sometimes we need to look at this from a little bit further outside than we put, maybe like to, but imagine if someone came into the board meeting at the Emory Sports annual big business meeting and said, hey, I'm going to take 25% of your revenue and give it to someone else. I don't think you would be in that meeting very long, because they own something that they sell and make money out of. And if they see an entity getting, you know, inches, even inches closer to diverting that decision process where they control everything, of course they react, right? Because they will do a power struggle, say, well, do you not want to ride the Tour de France? Well, good luck with that, you know, good luck telling that to your sponsors. So they want to make sure that they control as much as possible. And that's not just because they you know, it's not a cultural thing because they're French. It's because they run a business. And you can't really compete with 100 years of equity and think that they just give it away.
And this is why antitrust laws exist in every country, but it's very difficult to enforce. I mean, I've wondered about the EU enforcing some kind of antitrust legislation that would penalise the Tour de France, because how else do you deal with this monopoly? As we said last week, the Tour de France is the most beautiful golden goose in any sport. And if you look across the whole sort of sporting panorama, it's very difficult to identify any monopoly that rivals the one over which ASO presides. So
if there aren't any franchises that the team somehow can tap into, create an identity with, and have a steady income, the only real franchises are the races. Right, they teams can come and go. Riders' career will start, they'll stop, they'll you know, reach the zenith and create eras, but the tour goes on. Right, it might develop, it might take on different aspects, but it's not gonna go away.
Le tour.
So for obvious reasons, you it's not hard to predict how they'll react to anyone knocking on the door and asking for their money. But one thing that I early on caught on to, and because there's been a lot of writing about this, and some I think has been exaggerated and some hasn't, but let's say there even was a demand for a financial model where they would share the revenue of the Tour de France selling TV rights. The figures I've seen, it wouldn't even cover 10% of the current 18 teams' budget. So they're asking for something, you know, often if you ask for something, well, if there's a deficit, are you going to cover it then, right? If they say, well, we want equity in the product where we are the main characters, and then you'll say, well, okay, but it might not have a bottom line that you're very happy with. Are you then going to cover that? Because often when you ask for equity, you'll also be asked to, you can't just walk away if there's a bill being sent your way. But I think it taps into how the conflict between the teams and the tour, the French teams less so in the period after Festina. I think they would do anything the ASO asked them to. And the ASO, they did see the teams as potential enemies, because they almost ruined the race for them, I think the sentiment was. And so they weren't particularly interested in going into business with some of the team owners and the sports directors, who were the loudest voices on the team side at the time.
And Brian, one could argue that the only really, really valuable brand in the sport of professional cycling is the Tour de France. There isn't another team, there isn't another rider who is valuable in terms, in the sort of dimensions that... For example, last week we were talking about the prospects of investment by the PIF, the Saudi Investment Fund, of the kind of magnitude that they're interested in. When I spoke to someone last week about the prospects of the Saudis getting involved, they said, well, the returns are too small. And even if they were to take over the Tour de France, which is not going to happen, because the Tour de France is privately owned, and the family that owns the Tour de France have been pretty adamant that they would not sell the Tour de France. I also wonder whether there would be some kind of state intervention if they tried to.
I mean, we saw that
try to sell the Tour de France.
You know, with the antitrust, which is currently being activated by the Justice Department in the United States, figuring out whether the LIV Golf, the alternative golf league, can actually fusion with the PGA. You know, initially it caused a big divide in professional golf among the players, And it became almost like an ideological battle that then ended with LIV, the Middle Eastern Investment League, wanting to fusion with the PTAs. And now that's obviously, you know, it's unresolved, and I doubt that it's going to happen. But coming back to what we spoke about initially, imagine if you were a bank, a merchant banker or an investment fund doing due diligence. Would you rather own 80% of the UCI or 10% of the ASO? You know, I think that's, if anyone saying that would rather own the UCI, I'm not going to lend them any money, you know. So it is the biggest and potentially the only franchise, because it survived everything, and it has survived tendencies, it survived doping scandals, it's seen riders and teams come and go. And it's really there's a reason why they're forcing their hands sometimes when they see that threatened.
We are very proud to be partners with MAP, the Melbourne-based but global cycling clothing company, and the manufacturers and makers and designers, of course, of the fantastic Cycling Podcast jersey and range of accessories which came out last year. Now, as we approach Black Friday, I can only recommend that you keep an eye on the MAP website. That's map.cc, because I gather there may well be some pretty appealing offers in the run-up to Black Friday. You may remember at the start of the year that we featured MAP's Pursuit of Progression campaign, which was MAP's initiative to get cyclists all over the world to set themselves a goal for the 2023 season and perhaps challenge themselves more than they had ever challenged themselves before. And we threw it open to you, our listeners. We asked you to send in your cycling goals for 2023. And we heard from one of our listeners over in Northern Ireland, Lisa Jane McIlveen, who wrote in to say that her major goal for the year was to be fit enough to join her club, the ARD Cycling Club, on their annual cycling trip to Mallorca in October. She said she'd always wanted to go. The roads and routes look amazing, but to get there, I'll have to cycle consistently each week and also try to cycle on a few consecutive days. Now, we heard from Lisa Jane again a few days ago, and she has told us that although it was a last-minute decision, she did indeed make it on the club's cycling holiday to Mallorca a few weeks ago. On only the second day, she says, I climbed the Puig Mayor. I had zero experience of climbing mountains, so it was a baptism of fire, but I felt such a sense of achievement. I developed my attitude and approach to climbing the mountains and just got stronger as the week went on. It was an experience I'll never forget, and I have to admit that the fact that you featured me on the cycling podcast gave me extra motivation to go on the trip and to ride like I'd never ridden before. So thank you so much again. It meant a lot. Well, thank you very much, Lisa Jane, for writing in and letting us know that you made it to Mallorca. Really quite envious, actually, as the winter starts to close in here in the UK. A week cycling in the sunshine in Mallorca sounds absolutely ideal at this time of year. And I'm really glad that the Cycling Podcast and MAP played a small role in motivating you to be able to go and experience that week in Mallorca. Brilliant. Really great to hear that. And well, it will soon be time to set our cycling goals for 2024. But in the meantime, we are delighted to be partnered and kitted out by MAP. If you want to have a look at their range of clothing, go to map.cc.
Brian, in a minute, I want you to tell us a story. I want you to, again, take us by the hand and lead us down memory lane to around about 2011, 2012, when there was another instance of a group trying to break away from, well, particularly ASO, but also the UCI to a certain extent. But just on the Saudis, PIF, LIV Golf as well, our colleague Spencer Martin on the Move podcast, the We Do podcast that he does with Johan Brunel, made a really interesting point. He posited a very interesting theory whereby the LIV move in professional cycling would be the Saudi investment fund, if they can't take over the Tour de France, which we don't think they can, making a play for RCS. And then moving the date of the Giro d'Italia, when I say RCS, I mean RCS Sport, who owns the Giro d'Italia, taking over all of their races, moving the Giro d'Italia to a position where it competes with the Tour de France, much more advantageous slot in the calendar.
I'm starting to like this.
And And in the same way that LIV has offered, it has given golfers ludicrous sums, so that any moral compunction that they might have has completely gone out of the window. I think $200 million was the figure that was mentioned in conjunction with Phil Mickelson.
And that's to our listeners who don't follow golf. That is the check to one golf player. Okay, $200 million to
just
one
to show
player.
Up. Yep. Just to show up. No, it's not contingent on results. And Phil Mickelson is a player who is well past his best. What if Brian PIF? They buy RCS Sport. They buy the Giro d'Italia as well as other races who are willing to sell to them, and they move the Giro d'Italia to July, and they offer Tadej Pogacar €20 million to ride the Giro d'Italia. They offer Matthew Van Der Poel €20 million, and so on and so on and so on. Is that a threat?
Well, first of all, they'll still have to offer the teams who are not bringing their A game to the France. They'll still have to offer them, you know, guarantee them money that they could actually, you know, that they could fund all their operations and give a financial horizon. But I suppose as for the sake of argument, that's also part of it. We're talking potentially about an endless budget. But I think that's a very interesting point, and it's a lot more realistic scenario. It's 100 times more realistic than them making a bid to try and buy the Tour de France. And also RCS is in a completely different position business-wise and financially than the ASO is. You know, that in itself would make it pretty incentivized for them to at least explore such a deal.
Also has a, I would suggest, a bit of a different moral orientation, which is not to say that, you know, they subscribe to the same ideas as the Saudi Arabian, you know, kingdom. But we've seen with RCS, were they willing to take money to take the Giro d'Italia to Israel? Yes. We've seen this on numerous occasions with RCS, haven't we?
Yeah, but don't forget that also ASO has races and activities.
True.
In the Middle East, you know, they kind of like divide the February calendar amongst them in terms of organizing races. So I think even if we look aside the different moral outlook, which I think may or may not be relevant here, if you struggle as a business, you know, I coming back to the LIV Golf, I saw the Netflix episode about the golf players making those key decisions, and Ian Poulter made the case that, well, it's either this or I'm not going to be a relevant figure in my sport anymore, and I'm not going to be able to make the amount of money that I can here. So he was trying to make a personal case for, I mean, he's not on the brink of starvation in any shape or form, and neither is the RCS. But RCS doesn't have it's not as healthy a business, and it's not a strong a position for negotiating as the ASO is.
Who's the over the hill but decorated, possibly charismatic cyclist that LIV? Who's their Phil Mickelson? I've got a name in my head and a face in my head, but I'm not going to say it.
I'm going to let you
alienate people. Yeah.
Well, you confirmed it. I just made a suggestion.
Yeah. Anyway.
I suppose you can look at Israel Pro Cycling as almost, you know, the team that spent most amount of money on people's former palmarès more than their future. And that's what LIV has done in golf, really. They wanted these really big names who have also, you know, reflect a certain personality across the sport. And, you know, as long as they play against each other, it'll look like it's a fantastic competition. But I mean, if Chris Froome or someone who you know, arguably is beyond their best years, race someone that, you know, you'll also have like a senior, you could do a senior Tour de France, a former Tour de France winners that hasn't won it or being even close for a handful of years. But I think when that investment fund goes into cycling, they want the best, right? And they'll potentially throw any kind of money at it. They're not interested in anything less, and I think they have the financial firepower to, you know, to get what they want if it is just a question of money. And they I think they can also wait if they have to, because this is their bid for a relevant future, which is also, you know, we haven't talked about it yet. It's part of it that's sports washing, but it's part of it is also trying to create something that wasn't there already. We see that with, you know, Alula, and we see that with the races there, and we see that, you know, part sports washing also with the World Cup in football. So they're trying to create something. For many of those reasons for why they're doing it are obviously dubious. But if they invest that type of money in cycling, and I will put my name to that, they're never going to make that money back again. Like, never. So you have to look for the ulterior motives for why they want to do it.
I was discussing this with someone a few days ago who, again, had knowledge of the situation of this sort of one cycling project. And he said about the PIF and their investment in sports, their engagement in sports, one thing they definitely don't want to do is look stupid. They may look to the outside as though they're undiscerning by virtue of the amounts that they're willing to invest, but they certainly, it goes against all of the reasons why they want to get involved in sport, they certainly don't want to be embarrassed and to look like they've made foolish decisions.
If that's the case, then I would like to sit in on the debriefing of how that whole LIV Golf thing has turned out for them.
Well, that's been a huge success. I mean, they've sort of taken over the kingdom. I mean, they have. Yeah,
if they're able to merge with the PGA, and for those of our listeners who don't follow golf, it would probably be the same as if this investment fund merged with the UCI of sorts, right? I mean, that's probably the best example. If the UCI was a strong franchise and a financially stable, very stable entity, that's probably the best way to compare it, because they will be able to change the calendar, and the only way to change the calendar is to be in cahoots with the UCI.
Yeah, they will certainly, however this shakes out in LIV and in golf, they will certainly end up with a mark, with an imprint on professional golf at the highest level.
And don't forget that, involved. Which is very relevant to this discussion now in cycling, they are already a big part. They are already the biggest investor in cycling when you look at team sponsorships, when you look at the companies they bought, when you look at the teams that they finance. I think we can all agree that UAE has probably the biggest budget in the sport, and that money comes from someone who's potentially, you know, part of that investment or their neighbor, you know. So it's and you have Bahrain, you have Alula, you have some of these companies who probably own some of the bike manufacturers as well. So they are slowly closing in on it, and they probably already have quite deep knowledge of how cycling works.
Bizarrely, Brian, I already told you this, but yesterday I was walking in Merano in the north of Italy, close to where I'm staying, and I bumped into the CEO of the UAE team, Andrea Agostini, completely random, in a park just outside Merano.
Nothing happens by chance in pro cycling at this time.
He's from Cesenatico. He's, of course, he was a childhood friend of Marco Pantani, and he was, yeah, enjoying a bit of a break in Merano as well. They, of course, if we're to believe reports, and I should have asked Andrea about this, but we talked about other niceties, they are not supposedly involved in the One Cycling Harmony project as it currently stands. Brian, I said you would tell us a bit of a story about another occasion when there were plans afoot for a breakaway league in professional cycling. 2011-12 time, something called World Series Cycling. Some of the entities, some of the individuals involved that are said to be involved now with One Cycling Harmony Group. What was World Series Cycling? What was your involvement at that time?
I mean, initially it was, I was quite involved in the sense that I was a general manager for a team that was about to sign the contract and be part of the initial
Leopard Trek.
Yeah, the to be part of the initial group. And there was the impetus and the people behind it, I think they came from quite different areas. There was someone who had previously been quite high up in the UEFA. There was a London-based lawyer who had done all the groundwork to figure out how this could be constructed as an entity, as a business. And then there were, I wouldn't say, you know, as you say in French, the cyclisme, le vélo en deux vitesses, there was teams that were more hesitant, and there were team owners, team managers who were not very hesitant and who wanted, you know, head first into this. And there were different motives for it, and all of them weren't financial, in my opinion. There was also a lot of frustration with the ASO or the UCI or both. There was a lot of spite against certain ways of cycling repeating its flawed business model. And then it was also at the time when cycling saw very wealthy individuals underwriting, or call it sponsoring or whatever you want, of teams. You know, people like Jerry Ryan, Doug Ellis from Garmin Slipstream, Flavio Becker, whom I work for. So these were people who probably were quite surprised to see how poorly cycling was doing as a future investment, because the financial stability of having to look for sponsors almost on a yearly basis was not something. I mean, the only one that actually stayed on for the passion and not necessarily for the business, in my opinion, is Jerry Ryan. You know, he's underwritten that team for more than a decade now, and if he looked at it as a business model, and if someone was to give to him sound advice from a financial point of view, I think he would have dropped it years ago. But I think the overall idea was to not necessarily to get rid of, or maybe for some it was to get rid of the strong hold that the ASO and the UCI had, because the idea was to create races that didn't exist already. Right, so it was having a tour.
Grand Prix, I'm going to call them.
Grand Prix, like, and some of it has in a, you know, with not a fraction of any kind of success in the you know, the Hammer Series, and I see elements of that way of thinking in what was the original prospect from the company Gifted, it was called, I think, the company that structured how the competition was supposed to look like. So it was actually a 3-day event in the big cities of the world that would then be populated by the strongest riders in the world, and would be a very action-packed format with a mountain stage, maybe a sprinter. Almost like, imagine if Criterium International was to be held in Rio, Barcelona, New York, and London, and there would be a massive involvement with audience. There would potentially be ticketing and television rights to be bought and sold.
And, well, there's some quite amusing, entertaining accounts of some of the meetings in the book Le Fric, Family, Power and Money, The Business of the Tour de France by Alex Duff. Meetings in, for quite fractious meetings in some cases in London with bankers and some of the individuals that you described. You remember any of that, Brian?
Yeah, I went to a few of them, and I wouldn't say I hosted some of them, but there was a lot of activity on the same floor I was sitting on in an office building in Luxembourg. But it also reminded me, for two years I was on the board of the AIGCP, which is the overall, and still is, I believe, of sorts, and it also plays a role in the conflict now, I suppose, but it's the overall interest organization. It's kind of the lobby for all the teams put together, not just the... for all the professional teams, not just the World Tour teams. And one thing that always struck me in those meetings, both in the AIGCP, but also in the context of this new league, I think that was the nickname of it, or the Breakaway League, maybe it was the nickname of it initially, was that, and I think it's actually the crux of some of the problems, is that the team owners and the team managers, some are more sports directors than managers, and or vice versa, they couldn't get past the competitive element they had with other teams, a level of competition that has no relevance when you're not in a bike race, right? Unless you're competing for the same sponsor. I mean, who, if you take the 10 biggest teams in the world of cycling and ask them, do you want the sport to be more sustainable? Do you want the sport to be trustworthy? Do you want investments to make sense for us in the future? If any one of them said no, they would be out of their mind. But if you put them in the same room together, for some reason, they have all this almost like this
yeah. Petty almost animosities.
It's almost in the DNA that they have a level of competitiveness or mistrust amongst them that probably was one of the reasons why it never worked out.
Yeah, I think as well, you have to remember that was probably the most fractious time in professional cycling history. We were still, okay, we were beyond the years, we were beyond the sort of darkest times where, for example, 2007, 2008 Tours de France, when it looked as though the whole thing might grind to a halt. But of course, in 2013, we were going to have the, so in January 2013, wasn't it?
Yeah,
we were going to have the Armstrong confession. Just before that, we had a sort of slow rumble of stories leading up to that. We knew it was coming. And, you know, I suppose with regard to sponsorship and going right back to where we started this conversation about escalating costs, if you told someone, and I remember conversations I had with the likes of Bob Stapleton, who was the HTC manager back then, and he was a victim of exactly this sort of churn that we have referred to. That was a team that should, by any measure, have been very coveted by sponsors. It was the best team in the world. What they'd created was quite remarkable. And yet they found themselves without a sponsor and eventually had to close. But he would always talk about the spectre of doping and how any conversations with prospective sponsors basically ran aground because that was always looming. And if you told Bob Stapleton that in 10 years' time, 11, 12 years' time, that spectre really, for us who are involved in the sport, we talked earlier about Mikael Hessman's positive doping test being a sort of bolt from the blue, an unusual story. Bob Stapleton wouldn't have believed that, and if you told him no, that is the case, he would have probably have said to you, well, this sport is in the perfect position then to exploit, capitalize, squeeze out all of its potential. Alongside that, we've got the most exciting and in a lot of cases charismatic generation of riders that we've probably ever had, or certainly that I can remember, and yet we still have these problems.
The problems being financial ones, yeah?
Financial problems.
Yeah, yeah, it depends, because you can also overemphasize. I certainly don't know all the ins and outs of Richard Plugger's qualms regarding his budget, or and whether that led him to pursue the option of fusioning his team with Patrick Lefebvre's. I think it takes, I mean, I can see the parallel, because HTC was the most winning team ever, and it was quite telling that they weren't able to catch any significant sponsors, even though they tried. But I think there's also, and I certainly have a lot of respect for Bob Stapleton, but he was given, I believe, a budget horizon without having to spend a penny himself from the remains of the T-Mobile ruins, right? So he was given the budget, and they had no claim to wanting the name on the jersey or part of the title sponsorship. He never wanted to invest any money in it himself, not a single. I don't think he's ever invested any money in that team, and I think it's hard to go out as someone who was extremely wealthy as he was to sell a sponsorship when they say, well, are you at least going to bankroll it for another 4 months until we find one, right? Because he had riders that he could have and keep under contract. So I think that deserves to be said in that context, and it's something that people never mention when they mention him. And I also think sometimes in that era, especially from the American side, there was a tendency to always mention doping whenever to try and seem like you were trustworthy or distancing yourself from the Lance Armstrong side of things. And that made a lot of sense from a business point of view. But I also think that every time you mention anti-doping or the need for anti-doping, you also contextualize cycling in a way that almost you watermark into the sport that problem will always be there. And I think the only reason, and I'm not saying that the sport inherently changed its morals, but it's a new generation now. Right, we have riders winning. You know, Vingegaard was born the same year that Bjarne Riis won his first and only Tour de France. So it is a new generation. It's a different mindset, and they obviously know what happened on beforehand. But they came into the sport with a completely different
But a generation that's also the fruit of those very intense and painful efforts over several years by the likes of Bob Stapleton, Jonathan Vaughters, and so on and so forth.
And the biological passport, right? So of course, I mean, I'm not saying they weren't pioneers, but I also think that there was certainly a period of time where I think it was overemphasized, you know, more the problems there was in cycling than the actual willingness to do something about it other than just talking. That was my feeling when I was in the middle of it, because there was still problems, but I think we, you know, the looking back, we probably also overemphasized those problems for a little bit too long. And it was hard to sit in those meetings with potential sponsors. And by God, I've sat in a few. And it almost felt like you had to have a slide in your PowerPoint that talked about it, right? And you're potentially talking to people who don't even know cycling, you know. I'm not telling them that you shouldn't touch upon it because it's important. But I think also we didn't do ourselves a lot of favors in some of those meetings.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Well, Brian, I think that is probably enough business chat this week. Cycling business chat. I never really know whether it's a turn off to people. Cycling business chat, cycling politics chat. Brian, I've been reading a book over the last couple of days, Our Final Invention by James Barrett, about AI and how it's going to kill us all. And part of me thinks none of it's going to matter. And yeah, I think 2024 Tour de France might be the last one.
So you're in more of a
conclusion from reading that.
You retreated to the high mountains with the feeling of the apocalypse being forthcoming.
Yes. I will stand on a very high peak here in the Italian Südtirol, and I will be the last one standing, Brian. That's my hope, at least.
I'm glad I got to see you before it all happened.
There will still be episodes of the Cycling Podcast to listen to. Alas, there will be no listeners. There will be no audience for us, Brian. So, Brian, 2024 Tour de France. Of course, we had the presentation a few weeks ago. Lots been going on in professional cycling, Brian, in your absence, while you've been harvesting grapes in California, making wine, writing cookbooks. We've had the aborted Jumbo-Visma-Sudal Quickstep merger. We've had Primoz Roglic changing teams. Jonas Vingegaard being elected Velo d'Or winner in 2023, the best rider of 2023. We will elect our best rider of 2023, among other things, best team, and so on and so forth over the next few weeks. But Brian, what's caught your eye in amongst all of that, and maybe other stories that have hit the news over the last few weeks?
It was funny because I was flying into Florence the other day coming back from Copenhagen. Initially, I actually couldn't get back because of the floodings, and luckily that's somewhat under control right now. But flying into Florence, I was thinking about the Tour de France starting there in less than a little bit more than half a year. And it's quite interesting how people look at the 2024 Tour de France route, and opinions certainly vary. But I think there's a potential now that Roglic has changed teams, with Evenepoel coming in hot potentially for his first aim at the Tour de France, and Jonas Vingegaard. I know he won that prize, and if the prize was given for the strongest rider of 2023, easy outright winner, there's no doubt about it. The display of performance, his level in basically all the races that he rode, it merits that title. But I think
there's a big old
no,
but
no,
coming.
The but is the Tour de France only grows bigger because of this, right? And that's what we also talked about early on in the episode. Now it has the potential. I know I'm very much half full kind of guy, glass more than you, but the next year the Tour de France really has it has the potential to be the greatest race ever. If you look at the parcours, at least in my opinion, if you look at the lineup of riders, and it worries me a little bit for the Giro, it potentially worries me for the Vuelta. And when a rider like Van der Poel winning everything that he did, it was because he didn't win the Tour, or didn't win three stages, that he wasn't the best rider in the world, or that Pogacar didn't, you know, when you look at his palmarès of this year. So it just proves the point that the Tour is the measuring stick above and beyond for cycling. And if we agree with that premise to argue any conclusion, I hope that the Tour can live up to it next year.
I don't agree with you about the Vuelta. I don't think the Vuelta is in trouble. As I always say, the Vuelta is like that grotty nightclub that you always swear at the beginning of an evening out that you're not going to this week. You will definitely not visit La Vuelta. It would be a good name for a nightclub.
We actually have one of those nightclubs
near my university
here in Pietrasanta. And it's called the it's called the Cobra Club.
They usually have names like that. My sort of den of sort of disrepute at university was called Hombres, just off Leicester Square, and it was similar. Yeah, you would swear that you weren't going to go there, and you would end up there at 2 o'clock in the morning, well, propping up a bar,
drinking
paint.
I'm still waiting for my Walter invite. You know, I'm always doing it from a distance.
There you'd be paying your £7.50 for vodka Red Bulls, which probably cost about £15 now. So the Vuelta will always be fine, Brian. Okay. There will always be people
happy to hear that.
Queuing at La Vuelta, trying to get past the, well, very permissive, very porous door policy, entry policy for La Vuelta. Yes, interesting, Brian, interesting. Vingegaard, I said it on the podcast at the time, I sort of agreed with the choice of him being Velodor. I thought, well, in much the same way that you've just said the Tour de France is going to be the event of 2024, I thought it was the event of 2023. It was a brilliant race, and he was by far the best rider, and his season was perfect apart from 2 days at Paris-Nice, so I think he deserved it.
But
really,
in the era we're in, Daniel, with so many, I mean, we talked about that throughout the year, we're in an era of cycling now where we've never seen such a wide level of incredible athletes who can do almost anything in any terrain. And then, you know, it's extremely hard to win in that company, you know, even if everything that Tadej Pogacar did, he was also had an extraordinary season, but he didn't win the Tour, he only became second, right? And then Van der Poel winning everything, that's almost everything that you could create an entire career out of the year he had. So it's a very, very, it's hard to win the big races because of that elite group, which is so diverse now. So that it makes sense that it's very hard to pick a winner, because they're outright fantastic each of those seasons when you look at them individually.
Indeed, Brian. Indeed. Brian, on that note, I think we will conclude tonight's podcast. I have plans tonight to go and eat some Tyrolese mountain fare, Knederli, Knödel, dumplings, which is what are often consumed in these parts. Not really your sort of food, is it?
I'm looking at a very similar fare-ish. I'm having, I think, leftover osso, which is like a mountainish food, you know, with a nice glass of gattinara, which is Alta Lange, from Conterno Nervi. So yeah, I'm meeting you halfway up that hill.
So we're both doing just fine. Talking of wine, Brian, I've got a race of my own coming up at the weekend. Something called the Valtellina Wine Trail, which is the kind of thing that you would probably make a good fist of. I could see you as one of the leading competitors in that race, but it's a trail, it's a mountain trail
I would,
race.
Like, it will be a steep one, because the vineyards of Valtellina are horribly steep.
Well, yeah.
Because and that valley is so narrow and dark. You know, yeah, you would only see me running away from the Valtellina. It's a clone of Nebbiolo that I'm not very fond of.
Well, Brian, I will try my best to enjoy it on Saturday, and maybe report back next week. There will be a podcast next week, because there's a podcast every week, Brian. We're not sure who is going to be on it next week, but there'll be something for you listeners. And on that note, I will say good night, Brian, and thank you very much on International Cappuccino Day.
Thank you, Daniel.
Don't go ordering one tonight, please.
Thank you, then.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.